I'm Heather Vale, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Today, I'm speaking with Brooke Neubauer, founder and CEO of the Just One Project. The nonprofit's annual community giving campaign is now underway, timed with the upcoming holiday season. It's called Skip One to Give One for Just One. Brooke, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So what exactly is the Just One Project?
The Just One Project, our mission is to connect the community through volunteerism while creating access to fresh groceries and resources that can be really helpful to community members that are food insecure.
Okay. When did you start the organization?
2014, I founded the Just One Project. We weren't, operationalized. We didn't open up our first brick and mortar location and serve clients out of our pantry until 2018. So between those years, we just did mobily, where we would pop up into communities and host these awesome community markets. And volunteers have fallen in love with joining us. And we've been able to really help a lot of community members since then.
What was it that inspired you to start it?
I had this amazing girlfriend named Nicole, who was always doing amazing charitable things. She was always giving back, volunteering. She was always doing something for others. Mm-hmm. And I just felt so inspired by her. And I also noticed that that wasn't a big part of my life. And so I thought, let me try and see what that's all about. And I did one thing with her and it literally changed my life. And so I thought, how many other people out there were just like me, where they would totally want to do something to help somebody else? They just needed to be introduced to it. And sure enough, it became this thing that was bigger than Nicole, bigger than myself. And now we touch over 20,000 lives every single month.
Wow, that's incredible. You know, a lot of people want to give back to the community. They want to help others, but not everybody goes out and starts their own nonprofit.
Yeah, true. But you don't have to. That's the good thing. You can do just one thing, whatever that is, whether it's volunteering, whether it's donating, whether it's supporting a local nonprofit. If we all just did one thing to help somebody else or to help the community, wouldn't that be a magnificent world to live in?
Absolutely. So speaking of that, what is the Skip One to Give One for Just One campaign?
Sure. What we're trying to do is we're trying to make, really just create mindfulness. We know that people want to always pay things forward, so we're giving them a campaign to do so. We're asking people to skip a coffee, donate that amount to the Just One Project, and help us provide a meal or groceries to a client in need. So whatever it is, whether it's skip something, whether it's your coffee, your appetizer to your next dinner, your entire dinner, whatever it is that you want to skip in honor of this incredible campaign that will help food insecure residents in our community, skip it, give it for just one.
Nice. Okay. Do you have suggested donation levels, or is it just whatever people want to skip and donate that amount?
You know what? On our website, we do have amounts that they can donate, but really at the end of the day, it's whatever somebody wants to give. It really is skip something, whatever that something is, skip it and give it to somebody else.
Okay. And what's the Food for All project?
So Food for All is what we are mostly known for. We distributed about 6 million pounds of food last year directly into the community. Our Food for All program is our no-cost community market with wraparound services. It is our Meals on Wheels delivery. It is our pop-up and give, which we have over 44 mobile locations in the community that are mobile community markets. We have amazing farmers markets with fresh, free produce and just the most colorful veggies and fruits. And it's all of our food programs.
So if people are in need of those services, where would they find the mobile markets?
Well, we have a really great map on our website and also on our social media. And whether you're living in a senior center, we have over 30 locations across the valley and senior centers, senior living agencies, but also two 14 CCSD locations. So no matter where you are in town, you can get to us. And if you can't get to us, we have 7 amazing delivery drivers and a small army of volunteers that are always willing and able to help us out with deliveries. And so we can come to you, which is pretty awesome. Removing the barriers, whatever barriers are preventing someone from accessing food. We call it Food for All because we're going to make sure if you need food, our programs are built for you.
That's great. Do you also look for volunteers if any of the listeners are interested in volunteering or helping out in some way?
Absolutely. We can only do so much with we have our own little small army. The Just One Project has 50 amazing staff members. However, we have 10,000 volunteers in our database that are with us throughout the year. We cannot do what we do without our volunteers, and we are always looking to access fresh new volunteers that are new to our organization. We know that once they come out, they'll love it and they'll continue. And something really unique about our organization too is that we have no age requirement. And so we really want kids to fall in love with volunteering. We want them to be the Just One when they're old enough to, you know, go out and volunteer on their own. And we know the best way to do that is get them acclimated at a young age.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so where can listeners find out more information about the Just One Project or get involved with volunteering, donating, or becoming part of the holiday campaign and donating their one skipped thing, whether they're skipping breakfast, lunch, dinner, or coffee and donating? How do they do all that?
On your smartphone, any outlet, website, Google us, check us out on Facebook, check us out on Instagram. You'll be able to, on our social media, see all of our pictures, and you can see what we're up to Monday through Friday, and you'll likely love what you see, and you'll definitely want to come and give us a try.
Okay, and the website is thejustoneproject.org?
Yep, and that's for clients too. You know, we make it really easy for people to access our services. So whether you're a volunteer, whether you're a client, whether you're a donor, we want you to engage with us.
Okay, nice. So again, it's the Just One Project. You can find them on Facebook, you can find them on Instagram, or you can find them at thejustoneproject.org. thejustoneproject.org. You'll find information there about getting involved, helping out, volunteering, donating, whether you want to donate on a regular basis or if you want to become part of the holiday campaign, which is the skip one to give one for Just One campaign. You can skip a meal, you can skip a coffee, you can skip a dessert, you can skip an appetizer, and then donate the equivalent amount to the organization. That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Brooke, for being here and sharing with us what you're doing, what the project's all about, and how people can help, most importantly. You're doing a lot of good in the community, and I want to thank you for letting us know about it and also for doing it.
Yeah, thank you for giving us the opportunity to share with your listeners who we are and what we do, and we hope we see them soon.
Melissa from Michigan. I work an extra part-time job serving lunch at my child's school. But I still can't afford to put food on our table.
Daniel from California. Choosing whether to pay the rent or pay to fix the car to get to work doesn't leave us with much at all. Now we can't even pay for meals.
Hunger is a story we can end. End it at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Jay Caballero, Chief Rock Officer for the Rock Academy of the Performing Arts, or RAPA. RAPA's the music conservatory for the Delta Academy, a tuition-free public charter school for grades 6 to 12, and they have an all-new state-of-the-art music production lab. Dr. Jay has 26 years of experience in public education and over 40 years of music performance as a piano and keyboard player. Jay, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Heather, for having me. Appreciate it.
So when was the Delta Academy originally founded?
I believe they were founded in 2007. Mm-hmm. Of course, RAPA, we weren't a part of that, the beginning part. We're brand new to Delta Academy as of 2021. So, but yeah, they've been around for 14 or so years.
And why was the Rock Academy of the Performing Arts added to the curriculum at Delta Academy?
Yeah, just over time, we met people and networked. Of course, that's how things go and make things happen. And so I met Dr. Kyle Canold through mutual friends, and he was wanting to expand Delta Academy as just not just an academic charter school, but mm-hmm. to add the arts and then athletics. And I know that there's an athletic wing as well that was founded a couple of years before we came here. So yeah, that was it. He had a vision of expanding the school into arts and athletics. And then, of course, we at RAPA, as a contemporary music school, it was a really good fit for us and going into an established school like Delta Academy.
So besides having RAPA on campus, what do you think sets Delta Academy apart from other schools in the district?
Yeah, just a couple things. Is number one, the model. There's a couple of models. The main one, of course, is their online model for students that whatever reason they want to accelerate on that platform, mm-hmm. or there's a learning type of modality, I guess you could call it, that they would prefer to, or they could learn better on that platform, which is online. And so that's one of the main ones. It could be a small setting, which it is. It's a very small setting. School as compared to just a typical public school, especially a high school with 2,000 plus students in it. We have about under 200 students here at the school, even though the enrollment is at about 1,100. So most of them are online. Mm-hmm. So that's another pro for being at Delta Academy. And also small class sizes. We have probably on average 15 to 20 students in a classroom as compared to, of course, a typical public school, which can range anywhere from like 30 to 40 plus.
So for students who don't want to do the online option, where is the school actually located?
Yeah, we're in North Las Vegas. We're on main intersections are going to be Martin Luther King Boulevard, just a little bit south of Cheyenne.
So why would you say arts education and specifically music education is important for kids?
Research says there's the multiple intelligences, and it's not just about, of course, learning, reading, writing, and math is important. And it's also a focus, of course, for students that are eventually going to graduate from high school. So that's kind of like leading up to, of course, reading, writing, and math. And then you have the other subjects, social studies, sciences, and then perhaps any other types of electives that go along the way. And so music education historically has been as an elective, right? Mm-hmm. Even though a lot of the research that has been conducted, including ourselves, says that we in say music education, we span through the disciplines. There's music in math, there's music in reading, writing, and science as well. And so when a student has that interest or that passion, or even that multiple intelligence for music education, the research suggests that they do well in other of the disciplines such as math and science and the others. And so that's why it's important that we give that opportunity for students that have that interest, that passion, that intelligence for music education. And historically, unfortunately, music education has been not at the focus of public education, meaning that perhaps they're the first ones to go when there's any type of budget cuts. And we see that, because, monies go in to improve student achievement via reading, writing, and mathematics. And so music education perhaps is the ones that get left behind many times. Athletics is around. We could, discuss that as far as, monies, budget wise, it brings in monies to schools. Mm-hmm. And so typically athletics doesn't, is not the ones that get cut. It's the arts that, get put on the wayside when the monies are tight and budget needs to cut back. But it's extremely important. It's also an avenue for students to express themselves artistically when perhaps, they don't do that through athletics, or they don't do that through other types of arts or any type of extracurricular activities, music and playing instruments and singing. And also the other side of it is the technology side of music as well, getting to explore that. So that's why I believe it's really important that we keep it here. We ensure that it stays as a part of public school curriculum.
Yeah, because if you take away arts from the kids and the kids don't learn how to be artists, how to be musicians, how to be dancers, how to be singers, how to be what have you, then we have a world without art. And that's no fun, right? Like, imagine no music, no art, no movies, no TV shows. Like, that wouldn't be a world worth living in. We have to have the arts.
And let's face it, it's part of our society and culture. I mean, we don't think twice about, like you were saying, movies and music. It's there. And we, as consumers, we pay for it. You know, we listen to music, we buy music, we you know, go to movies, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so we see that every single day, concerts, right? We go to concerts. We don't think twice about that. But when it comes to education wise, we do. We as in, you know, decision makers, we think twice about that,
yeah,
because of the priorities, which is like not a knock on, of course, yeah, reading, writing, and mathematics in order to be a productive person in our society. Of course, we need that, mm-hmm. but we can make the case that music education and arts education as well is just equally as important.
Absolutely. So you mentioned the technology side of music. Tell us more about this new production lab and how that's going to benefit the students.
Yeah, so this is our second year here at Delta Academy, and the first year was you know, just intro to music theory, contemporary music theory, as well as history of modern rock from the, you know, 1920s on to current. So that just gives the students just a foundation from where they're at contemporary wise musically and as well as theory. But then this year we introduce to take it to another level, a music production laboratory, which is totally hands on. And we are using, right now, we have two of the three main, what we call digital audio workstations, or DAW for short, D-A-W, which mm-hmm. is Pro Tools, which is totally industry standard. I don't know the percentages, 90% of all recording engineers use Pro Tools, or maybe higher than that.
Yeah.
But then there's another one called Ableton Live. Same thing. It's just a totally industry standard platform that we're using here at the school. And then the other one, which we're not using because we don't have Macs, that we're, you know, we're using PCs, but is Logic Pro from Apple, right? So those are the three main ones mm-hmm. in the industry. And we're using two out of the three to teach our students about music production: Ableton Live and Pro Tools for creating beats, also for recording instruments, whether it be MIDI files, synthesizers, as well as audio. It could be vocals, it could be guitars, bass, you know, just the instruments as well. So that's what they're learning now. It's a total introductory course for some students in Ableton and then some students in Pro Tools. And then, so, you know, moving forward, then, you know, we'll just get into more advanced studies, because this is only our second year, but we introduced this lab. It's just been fantastic. We're using Ableton Push 2s, which are, again, these industry standard interfaces to connect everything together. We have MIDI controller keyboards, allowing students to, you know, use keyboards and use piano and get that into the DAW, which is Ableton or Pro Tools. And so it's so dynamic that students are able to use this stuff that me as an adult in my professional life have been using. And, you know, I didn't use this, of course. The technology has changed, of course, since I've been in school, but nonetheless, you know, our students are getting, I don't know, with lack of a better term, like college level type of courses, or even just as adults, you know, just adult education. That's the type of experiences that they're getting, which we're totally excited about. And this is brought on with our partnership, of course, with the Delta Academy. So we're just grateful for this partnership and Dr. Knoll, the superintendent at Delta, to bring this lab to fruition.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's actually what I was going to say. It sounds like college level education. And let me just remind everybody, we're talking about middle school and high school students here, and they're getting this incredible state of the art music education, not just how to play music, but how to produce music, record it, mix it, all of that. That's incredible.
Yeah, just to clarify, just so you know, the audience is clear, we are actually 9 through 12.
You know, it's not 6 through 12?
Yeah, Delta Academy is 6 through 12.
Got it.
But RAPA.
And RAPA is 9 through 12.
9 through 12, even though our middle schoolers see what we're doing. And so they kind of peek into our class, our lab, and say, what is this? When, you know, we show them, and when they get promoted from eighth grade to ninth grade, then they're more
they'll all be signing up. They'll be in there. It's like, hey, do I get to play with it now?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, so where can listeners go to find more information about both Delta Academy in general or specifically the Rock Academy of the Performing Arts?
Yeah, of course, we have our website platform. There's two. For one, for RAPA is rapalv.com. So rapalv.com. Mm-hmm. So on that, of course, all the specific information's about our program, our conservatory. And then, of course, on Delta Academy's website, which is deltaacademylv.com. And we have just a little part of their website on there for us. But nonetheless, people could just go on to rapalv.com for more information. Social media wise, we're on Instagram. Our presence is on there as well as Facebook. So our tag or our handle, I guess it's called, is at Rapa Las Vegas for Instagram. And then on Facebook as well, it is Rapa Las Vegas as well. So yeah, we also have a TikTok. However, we're still kind of building that.
Okay. So if someone is already going to Delta Academy, do they have to apply separately to be able to take the RAPA classes?
Yes. So we are, like I said, we are the conservatory, and that implies that, you know, it's a separate program, mm-hmm. right? However, students are, at this point, they're auditioning to get into the program. But, you know, being a new program, you know, we're looking for people that just have interest and passion for what we're doing, regardless of their skill level. So thus, we do take beginning, middle, and advanced players. And I'll tell you right now, after 2 years, most of our students are or came from the beginning level. We had a handful that came in at intermediate / advanced. But for the most part, we're just taking anyone that's showing interest and wants to learn from our group of instructors. So yeah, Delta Academy students that see what we're doing, it's simple as filling out that enrollment request on our website. Mm-hmm. And then of course I'll get that. And then like I said, we do an audition, but it's more of an interview. You know, we're definitely not at a point where this is a like a really competitive, like say Berklee College of Music in Boston.
It's not right? Like Fame, the TV show
it's
Fame.
Definitely not, it's definitely not like that yet. And I say yet. Perhaps in 5 to 10 years, you never know. As the word gets out about our school and program, perhaps it'll get to that point. But right now, hey, it's just you know, we're going to grow the program, and we invite, of course, Delta Academy students, but students out there. There's, you know, hundreds of thousands of students in our district that probably don't know about us yet, but we welcome any of those students that want to come in and check us out.
So basically the criteria is just high school students, and if they're interested in learning music or music production, they can go to the website rapalv.com and apply to be part of the curriculum?
Yeah, that's right. And of course, we have our expectations, you know, the academics, you know, we're in the business of graduating students, right? So that's first and foremost. And then so they're going to come in. This is during the interview process. You know, we're going to see where they're at, you know, grade-wise. But there's a caveat to that, in that if this is a place where students feel that this is where I should be, or this is like my fit or my mm-hmm. niche, right? And they weren't successful in, say, their previous either middle school or high school for whatever reason, but they said, you know what, if I would have known about this a long time ago, you know, I would have tried to become a part of this program. That's what we're looking for as well, because if that's a way for a student to get motivated and to, you know, excel in their academics, fine. So it's not as if a student comes to us with, you know, all failing grades. Of course, that's a factor. But if we know that, hey, this is going to get them going, then we're all for it. And we've seen, quite frankly, a handful of our students in that boat, meaning that they were not successful for whatever reason in their middle school. They're not motivated. You know, they just did not care about school, I guess, to put it lightly. But they come here and they're interested in music, but then that translates over to their academics, and which we do monitor on a weekly basis. You know, we just ensuring that they're successful, they're on track to pass and get credits for their classes in order to graduate, because they need the 23 credits to graduate from high school with a high school diploma. And so they know that that is the priority. Yes, RAPA is great and everything, and we're glad you're here, but we're here to see you graduate from Delta Academy as well. So if that made sense,
yeah, like,
yes, we're taking, we're, you know, there's an expectation for academics here as well as citizenship. But at the same time, if we know that you are motivated, and this is going to turn things around for you, we will gladly accept you.
Awesome. Okay. So once again, if you want to find out more about Delta Academy, it's deltaacademylv.com, middle school and high school, primarily online, but also some of the students are there at MLK and Cheyenne at campus. But you can find out all the information at deltaacademylv.com. And then the Rock Academy of the Performing Arts, or RAPA, if you want to find out more about that program, go to rapalv.com. RAPALV.com, RAPALV.com, or Instagram and Facebook at RAPA Las Vegas. And Dr. J, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting people know about this school, because I don't think a lot of people know, let alone about Delta Academy, but definitely not about the Rock Academy of the Performing Arts, because you're so new, but you're doing such amazing stuff there. So I'm so glad you're here to let more people know about it and share with us what you guys are doing. So thank you for being here.
You're very welcome. And I thank you too, Heather, for having us up on this platform to just get our word out and just to let people know, like you're saying, you know, not a lot of people know about us yet, but perhaps 5 years from now, you know, we might be a household name in Las Vegas. You never know.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks again, Jay.
All right, Heather. Thanks a lot.
The future depends on teachers who are reinventing the classroom and starting their students on journeys that will change the course of history. Shape the future. Teach. Learn more and receive free support at teach.org.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Today I'm speaking with Ebony Walton, statistician with the National Center for Education Statistics, or NCES. Ebony directs the development and review of reports for the NCES's National Assessment of Educational Progress, also known as the Nation's Report Card. Ebony, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
So what exactly is the National Center for Education Statistics?
The National Center for Education Statistics is our federal statistical agency that collects information about the condition of education across the country. So we have been in existence for over 100 years, actually, and the assessment that we're talking about today actually existed for over 50 years. So we've been collecting data on students' progress and what they can do in mathematics and reading for a half a century.
Wow, that's great. So how did the pandemic affect students and their level of achievement?
Yes, so the latest data that we just released this morning shows that students in grades 4 and 8 mathematics and reading really did have a hard time performing at the same levels that they did before the pandemic began. We're seeing significant declines in performance pretty much across the board in mathematics particularly, and we're also seeing some declines in 4th and 8th grade reading.
What do you attribute those declines to?
That's a great question. There are so many factors that we believe that are related to the results that we see. We do believe that the instruction that students were able to get highly correlates with what students can actually do and perform on the assessment. And so what you're seeing, as we all know, as we all endured, there were so much disruptions in how students received instruction. And we believe that these results are showing evidence that students did have a hard time performing, again, at the same levels that we saw that they did in 2019.
Okay. A lot of schools made the decision and a lot of school districts made the decision to go to distance learning. So they did their classes over, you know, various different video conferencing programs. Do you think that was a mistake, or under the circumstances, was it the right decision?
We believe that there is no straight line to the declines that we see and what one school did versus another school did during the pandemic. We're seeing so much widespread declines, even, like I said, in mathematics, particularly grade 8, where you see basically across the board, regardless of what the state did or what the district did, we're seeing declines in performance. So we don't necessarily see the connection. Of course, we're going to do more study with more data and more research. Mm-hmm. But from the initial drop of the data, we do not see a strong correlation at all with the decisions that schools made, whether or not to stay in person or learn remotely.
Interesting. Okay. What feedback have you received from teachers and from students about their experiences during the pandemic?
Well, that's a great question. Part of our data collection is surveying teachers and students and also school administrators about their experiences. We did ask specific questions about what students in schools endured during the pandemic, and we have seen that teachers, students have reported some difficulties in learning or providing instruction during these past 2 years. We also see differences between lower performing students, whether or not they had access to computers all of the time, whether or not they had real-time access to their teachers all the time. We're seeing lower performers have a harder time with those resources than we did for higher performance during COVID. So there's so much data in our surveys, but that's one of the key things that we did identify.
Okay. So I would say probably for this school year, 2022-2023, a lot of schools are back to, let's say, business as usual. So they're back to how they were operating pre-2019. How long does it take for those results to kind of filter down so that you're able to see whether we're on the, maybe we're on the upswing now?
That is a great question. With our assessments kind of go back in time. We don't necessarily have a predictive line that we do, but with our program, we are in place to measure progress. So we do look forward to seeing how students with the schooling that they are receiving now, how they do recover in the next 2 years, 4 years, as we continue to collect these data.
Awesome. Okay. So where can listeners go to get more information or even to see the results of the poll?
Great. Yes. If everyone would go to nationsreportcard.gov, you can access all of the data. You'll have data for your state. We also have 26 urban districts that you can receive data. So nationsreportcard.gov will give you so much information about what students know and can do in 22.
Nice. Okay. So once again, nationsreportcard.gov is the website, nationsreportcard.gov. You can find all the data there, filter it down by state and district. And Ebony, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting people know, first of all, what your data has revealed. And also now I'm curious to look forward and see, you know, keep checking the data as we go forward. So thank you for the resource, nationsreportcard.gov.
Thank you much.
I asked what kind of family she wanted. She said, a family like yours.
Learn more about adopting a teen at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and joining me today is Joan Lynch, Chief Content and Programming Officer for Working Nation. This is National Disability Employment Awareness Month, and Working Nation is investigating the state of employment for neurodiverse and disabled Americans. Joan, thank you for being here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So what is the current state of employment for people with autism or disabilities?
Yeah, unfortunately, it doesn't look good. We're talking about a group of people that have over an 80% unemployment or underemployment rate at this point. And, you know, we're talking about more than 6.5 million people in this country. So this is why it's incredibly important, why we've dedicated this month to talking about this, because businesses that we know are looking for employees, desperately looking for employees. And yet there's this great untapped talent pool of people that have skills that might not be as easily understood by employers, but once they are, there's a business case for why you should be hiring them.
Okay, so what sort of benefits do people with autism or developmental differences or disabilities bring to the workplace?
Sure. The business case for it and the benefits start with profitability, which is one of the things that employers want to hear most. One of the things that we hear is the retention rate for these employees is incredibly high. They're very loyal and reliable. You know, we joke about being punctual, coming in on time, showing up for work, but this is one of the groups of people that is most known for that kind of detail. So their focus on detail, their concentration, their recall, oftentimes some technical strengths that you just don't know. Some of these folks may not have gone to college, but they're also in their homes, either independently or with their families, and they're building apps on their own. they have these skills that employers have no idea they have. And so we're trying to tell stories about, well, how do you find that out? How do you interview these folks? What do you have to do in order to understand what they're good at? Because the back end of that is your business is going to be more profitable. You're going to have these people longer. And for morale, it has been shown that, you know, folks love to work alongside people that are different from them. Diversity and inclusion is sort of what everybody's talking about now. And this is a group of people that needs to be included in that.
Okay, so what is the answer to that question that you posed? What is the proper way to interview, to find out the skills that people have? Because if this many people are being overlooked, obviously some questions are not being asked the right way.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. One example that I love is EY, a consulting company, has a great program. They do a camp. Not all employers can do this, but I'll give you this as an example. They do a camp that's week long where they bring in highly functioning neurodiverse or autistic possible employees, and they basically spend time with them and they put them in different opportunities and they talk to them. They train their HR directors that in a lot of cases, it's really a communication issue. Some of these folks really do only answer yes or no questions. Mm-hmm. And yet they can solve the most incredible problems. So, you know, years ago when we started Working Nation, we told stories about soft skills and people would talk to me about, you know, we can't find anybody that makes eye contact with us. Well, now we're understanding as we tell these stories, you know, a great number of these people that might be neurodiverse, which is very broad in terms of what that includes, may not make eye contact with you. It might make you uncomfortable or their fellow employees uncomfortable. But once you start to understand they're listening, they're processing, they're completing their tasks, you start to understand, oh, this is really about me. My character is, I feel as if someone isn't making eye contact with me, then they're not listening to me or not responding to me. So I think it's a big education process for both the employers, you know, the employees that are already there, and then also for the people that are job seekers to understand and to try to find some tools to better some of their skills, if possible.
Okay. So besides the hiring process and interactions on the job, what are some ways that companies can create a more inclusive workforce overall?
There's technology that exists that makes it easier now. And I'll give you an example in Las Vegas. There's something called Sensory Nook, which is a technology that makes it emotionally more comfortable for people that are neurodiverse to work alongside other people, perhaps in a room that is really loud. In fact, Alliance Stadium in Las Vegas uses it now for major sporting events so that they can bring in the neurodiverse population as a fan base to participate and watch the game and listen to the game without it being upsetting to them. So there's technologies out there for the neurodiverse, for the blind, for the deaf that are all accessible. And our partner, deliveringjobs.org, is a great organization, and they have a place where employers can go sign up, sign a pledge to be more inclusive or to try to be more inclusive, and then to find the resources. They'll get the resources to these employers in terms of answering the questions of what do I need in order for my workplace to be accessible to this workforce? And we're finding that when they do that, again, they're more profitable and they're happier and they have a much more diverse workforce.
Nice. Okay. So you mentioned deliveringjobs.org. Is that the best place for businesses and individuals to go to find out more information about this topic?
Yeah, deliveringjobs.org, along with our website where we're telling the stories and the journalism, which is workingnation.org.
Awesome. So once again, you can go to deliveringjobs.org if you want to find out more information. If you want to find out more about what Working Nation is doing in general, that's workingnation.org. So deliveringjobs.org and workingnation.org. And Joan, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting people know more about this topic and what the situation is and what can be done about it. It's been very enlightening. So I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks. Have a great day.
We are the 25%. That's a quarter of all Americans, over 61 million people with a disability. And we want a world where everyone is 100% included, just like you. Easter Seals Disability Services. We are the 25.org.
I'm Heather Vail, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me today is Kate Mangino, gender expert and author of Equal Partners, How to Improve Gender Equality at Home. Kate works with international organizations to promote social change. She's written and taught in over 20 countries about issues such as gender equality, women's empowerment, and healthy masculinity. Kate, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So what prompted you to write your latest book, Equal Partners?
I've been doing gender work for years, and I found that I was having wonderful, sophisticated conversations with communities around the world, Zambia, Indonesia, Malawi, and I was finding that I was having rather antiquated conversations about gender in the United States, in my own communities, with my own friends and family, especially since I became a parent 11 years ago. And so this book was my way to sort of bridge, you know, my professional life and my personal life and find entry points for communication around gender in the United States.
Okay, so in the 21st century, why is gender inequality still an issue?
You know, I wish I knew the answer to that, but the honest truth is that it is still an issue. I mean, I have a couple of theories as to why it's still an issue. I think that a lot of it goes down to our norms, our gender norms, that those are the unspoken, unwritten assumptions and expectations that we have around men and women. I think we've rewritten a lot of those norms over the last several decades. I think we're making progress, especially in the workplace and in education. But I do think that when it comes to our home and our personal lives and our intimate relationships, there's still a lot of assumptions about women being coded as caregivers, women being better at handling domestic affairs, being better at multitasking, men not being as good in caregiving. And I think those unspoken norms are still lingering, and I think they affect very much the way we behave today.
So a lot of women feel pressure to be super mom, you know, and myself included. So we want to be moms. We want to work. We want to have careers. We want to do everything. Is that possible?
I don't think it is. And I think that the most recent standards around parenting, you know, it gets harder and harder every year. I think I'd love to have us stop that conversation about, are you a super mom? Are you a not super mom? I think what it comes down to it is, let's talk about what parents need to do to be effective parents. You know, all parents have the capacity to earn money and provide for their children materially. And all parents have the capacity to provide for their children in sort of a nurturing emotional way as well. So I would just love to see that conversation shift to talk about people of all genders and what they can do as parents, as opposed to putting more pressure on mom and what kind of mom she wants to be.
Okay, so if all the burden can't be on mom's shoulders, but mom still wants to both be able to work and nurture the family, what's the answer? What do we do to remove the inequality and find a more balanced household?
So everyone that I interviewed for my book was a dual working couple. So I do think if you choose to have one person stay home part-time or full-time, that dynamic might shift. But for my book, the research was all with couples who are in long-term committed relationships who both work, participate in the economy, and earn money. We can't say work outside of the home anymore because so many of us
work at home.
So participate in the economy is what I think people are saying. So if both of you are working and you're both making money, then what can you both do in the home, you know, to make sure that you're both doing cognitive labor and you're both doing physical labor? The physical tasks, we know what those are. They're easy to see. And we've talked about these for a long time. And a lot of times we get hung up on chore distribution. You know, we're talking about who's doing the dishes and who's folding the laundry and who's going grocery shopping. But there's also so much cognitive labor that goes into running a household, anticipating needs, making decisions, doing research, evaluating things, managing schedules. It takes an enormous amount of time and pressure to balance all of that. And so I think true equality is when both partners, regardless of their gender identity, so I include same-sex and queer couples in my data set, is that both of them are taking on an equal amount of physical and cognitive work.
So for men who are used to more traditional roles and want to stick to more traditional roles, in other words, they want to be able to work 40 hours or however many hours a week and not have to worry so much about taking care of the housework and the childcare and, you know, everything else that goes on in the house, how do we convince them that, hey, it's actually a benefit for you as well to contribute to the ecosystem at home?
So I think what the way you phrased that question was perfect, because we're not just talking about a justice issue. We're not asking people to behave differently because it's just better for women. This is an equity issue. So inequality is bad for everyone, and gender equality is better for everyone. The men that I interviewed for my book are already living as equal partners. I decided to find those positive deviants in our society, and through interviews with them, kind of figure out where they came from and what influenced them and what makes them want to be equal partners. And I actually started the process at the very beginning of my research, asking a question, do you mind giving things up? Because I think I made that incorrect assumption that men were going to have to make sacrifices, maybe give up, I don't know, time with their friends or more relaxation time or free time on the weekends. And why was it worth giving that up to be an equal partner in their home? And I was very quickly corrected by the men that I interviewed, who said, no, we're not giving up anything. We are not sacrificing anything. We are doing this because it is better for us. We have better relationships with our spouse or our partner. We have better relationships with our kids. We feel emotionally connected to people that we didn't have that opportunity with our own father, for example. So we that relationship with our own dad that was a little distant and uncertain, I have a totally different relationship with my own kids. I heard from men that they felt so relieved that they could be their own self in the home. They didn't have to put on airs or pretend to be a certain way. They didn't have to make a certain amount of money to be accepted. They didn't have to be in charge all the time. They were allowed to be themselves. They were allowed to be scared or uncertain. And that being able to be their own genuine selves in their home and having those really close relationships made all of it worth it.
Okay. So having a mindset around equality is amazing. But when we're looking at quote unquote traditional roles for men and women, obviously biology is a factor. Only women can carry a child and breastfeed, for example. But beyond that, are there any reasons to stick to traditional roles? Are there any positives to maintaining traditional roles in the household? Is there any scientific data to support that that works?
I have not seen any scientific data to support the fact that that's a better way of life. I do say very openly and honestly that if you have a listener in a traditional relationship and you're both genuinely happy with that distribution of labor, I would never ask anyone to change. I think being in a partnership is hard. Raising a family is hard. Whatever way you do it that works for you is fantastic. I think I wrote my book because the majority of couples in North America right now are dual earning, and there still persists, even though both people have a job outside the home and are earning income, there persists this norm. And we've seen the statistic that's pretty much been plateaued since the mid-80s, that in different sex households, women do 2/3 of the work and men do 1/3 of the work. And over time, this has negative, repercussions for both partners. So I think if you're both making the decision to be out in the workforce, you should also both have, equal chance to take care of caregiving and household chores, and you should both have equal access to leisure time and relaxation time.
Okay, so what's step one? How do we make our homes more fair and equal?
All right, so you said step one. So I'm gonna take this way back to one, if you're okay, because I think
sure.
We'll have steps here. But number one is a lot of gender norms, they're learned, they become part of who we are, they can become part of our behaviors. It's easier to change them from the onset than when you're already in them. So working with kids, I think, is going to be step number one. We've changed the way we've worked with girls over the last 10, 15 years. We talk about women's empowerment. We've shattered glass ceilings for girls. let's talk about caregiving with boys. Let's make sure our sons and nephews and grandsons and neighbors have access to babysitting, can care for younger siblings, can participate in senior care. So that would be step one. Step two, I think, is talking to new couples, you know, being really honest with people who are just moving in together, maybe getting engaged, that this is a major issue among married couples who are in their, you know, 30s, 40s, and 50s. And if they value gender equality, they're going to have to take it head on, that if you don't talk about it and you just kind of go into default mode, we've seen that couples sort of fall back into these very gendered patterns. You have to be intentional and you have to have many conversations about it. My book offers lots of discussion questions you can have with your partner to start that conversation so that you can think of ways to manage your own household and find equality.
How do we make workplaces more fair and equal as well?
That's a great question too. So I think that, you know, if you're talking about two people at home and what they're contributing to their household and they're both working, the flip side is that the work that those people do is highly going to impact what they do at home. So workplaces need to have policies and cultures that support all people backing away from work once in a while to take care of caregiving, whether that's an afternoon off to take a child to the dentist or a month off because you have to transition a parent into assisted living. We need to, you know, I've seen people sometimes become a little hypocritical where a boss will say, a female boss, I want my husband to be an equal partner at home, but I expect my employees to, you know, be on email at 9 o'clock at night on a Wednesday. So I think we need to have really consistent messaging. And if we're going to support equal partnership, then we need to help people set boundaries at work as well as set boundaries at home.
This is a big topic and, you know, there's a lot involved and I want to make it easy for people. So what are the top takeaways that people could implement right away into their lives?
I think another thing that I like to talk about is to acknowledge that this is a problem that is far bigger than any one family or any one individual. This topic tends to rest in the nuclear household, but this is an intergenerational social problem. It was something that was handed to us. We didn't invent inequality. And I think that it's going to take everyone to get us closer to equality. So a lot of people think, oh, I'm not married, I'm not partnered, this isn't my issue. Or I've been married for 45 years and we have our patterns and my kids are grown, so this isn't my issue. I would love everyone to embrace this issue and say, there's something I can do. It might be about the way we talk to the kids in our life. It might be about the way we talk to our sons and daughters or our workplaces or the policies that we're suggesting in our workplaces. Do you have paid caregiving policies at your work if you're in a leadership or a supervisory role? So I think one of my core messages is I would just love anyone who values gender equality to understand that there's something they can do.
Okay. So how do people find out more about your book or gender equality in general?
My book is available from all of the usual bookseller outlets, your favorite online or brick and mortar bookstore. I try to keep updated with events on my website, katemangino.com. And if you have any questions at all or want to reach out, I share my email address on my website, and I'm also active on Twitter at Mangino Kate.
Okay, awesome. So once again, that's katemangino.com, K-A-T-E. Mangino is MANGINO.com, katemangino.com. If you want to find out more about Kate, find out more about her book. The book is called Equal Partners, How to Improve Gender Equality at Home, and you can get it at any of your favorite book vendors. Equal Partners by Kate Mangino. And once again, the website, katemangino.com. Kate, I want to thank you so much for being here today, talking to us about this issue, letting people know what the mindset is out there and how they can make positive change in their own lives and their own households. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Heather.
When I was younger, I may have did some stupid things, even committed some crimes, but I am not a criminal.
Youth Advocate Programs is a community-based alternative to youth incarceration, congregate placement, and neighborhood violence. Learn how at yapinc.org.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Hope Week to support Hope Link of Southern Nevada is happening through November 12th. It's a week of fun events to kick off the holiday season, closing out with the Jammin' for Hope concert at Fremont Country Club next Saturday, November 12th. Jammin' for Hope features the Soul Juice Band, Chicks Who Rock, and Frankie Perez, plus an open jam session with Ronnie Lee and a private VIP guest performance by Nieve Malandra. HopeLink of Southern Nevada has been preventing homelessness, preserving families, and providing hope for over 30 years. Find all the details and calendar of events at linktohope.org. That's link, the number two, hope.org. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, November 7th at 8 p.m., benefiting the Burlesque Hall of Fame, and Monday, November 24th at 8 p.m., benefiting the Vegas Theater Company. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. The Office of the Clark County Clerk and the Las Vegas Wedding Industry are honoring Armed Forces members with a chance to win free weddings or vow renewals through Las Vegas Marries the Military on Thursday, November 10th. Submit your application or find out more at lvmarriesthemilitary.com. That's lvmarriesthemilitary.com. The ALS Association Nevada chapter is holding their 1 mile walk to defeat ALS on Sunday, November 13th at 12 noon, with check-in starting at 10:30 a.m. at Craig Ranch Park. Sign up to walk or find out more details at alsanv.org. That's alsanv.org, or on Facebook at ALS Association Nevada chapter. And Make-A-Wish Southern Nevada is holding their second annual Trailblaze Challenge presented by Subaru of Las Vegas on February 3rd to 5th, 2023, with a 12-week training starting this month. This is a 26.2-mile hike through the Valley of Fire backcountry in Mesquite, with the goal of raising $300,000 to grant wishes for children with critical illnesses in Southern Nevada. Sign up or find out more information at wish.org/snv/trailblaze. That's wish.org/snv/trailblaze.